Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Trump replaced the inspector general who was supposed to oversee the $2 trillion economic recovery package. We'll learn more in just a bit. First, it's Food Friday, and our guest is a Wisconsinite passionate about sandwiches in general, and in particular, he really likes breakfast sandwiches. It's been 5 years since he first vowed to eat and write about one sandwich a week, and now his blog, 52 Sandwiches, is still going strong. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of breakfast sandwiches? What is your favorite combo? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Patrick Lochterman is our guest. You can see and read about the sandwiches on his blog at 52sandwiches.blogspot.com and see pictures of gooey eggs, melty cheese, and toasty buns on his Instagram at Bun Breakfast. Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
What is it, Patrick? I mean, I like breakfast sandwiches, but you really like breakfast sandwiches. What is it about them that you love so much?
I think you kind of nailed it in that little intro there. I mean, they're greasy and they're gooey, and you got that cheese, you got the crispy bread or the bun or whatever you've got it on, and you got the salty bacon, and maybe you've got some other stuff on there, and it just blends really well. It's just a great, great way to start the day.
Now, looking at your blog, you spent a lot of time going from restaurant to restaurant trying their stab at a breakfast sandwich. Why did you want to blog and record your efforts here?
I wish I had a good answer for that. I ate a really good breakfast sandwich on New Year's Day in 2015, and it just set the day off to such a good start. I felt so good about it, and I thought, well, I'm going to start trying these at everywhere I can think of. And I don't know why I decided to start a blog, because blogs are, even in 2015, seemed kind of old at that point. But that's what I did. I guess I don't have a good reason.
And you also sometimes try to make them at home, especially lately. I think you've shared some of your efforts at home breakfast sandwich making, since we can't go and sit and eat them at restaurants. How's it going? How's it going with your home experimentation?
Well, honestly, I had one for lunch today, so it's still going. I've been making a lot at home in general, but of course, especially lately. And, part of that is just to try to, recreate what I have in various restaurants. And part of that is the ease factor. I mean, it's really hard to go out for breakfast every week, and it's pretty easy to make them, you just have to have a few things around the house. And so I'd say it's going well. And I do like changing it up. I mean, sometimes it's just a simple, new kind of cheese that I've found or a new hot sauce or something like that. I don't get too wild with it generally, but I do like to change it up for each sandwich.
Well, we don't avoid controversy, Patrick, on this show. I really like runny egg yolk on my fried egg sandwiches and whatever else goes with them. Some people really don't. I think it grosses them out. Where do you stand on the runniness of the egg?
Oh, I'm with you. I'm pro runny yolk, but I know at least one of my friends thinks it's disgusting. So, there you go.
Yeah, there's no delicate way to eat one of those. You're going to ruin a couple napkins, and that's just all there is to it.
Right, maybe that's a good thing. Once you pick up half that sandwich, maybe you can't put it back down, and you're just dedicated to it. You just focus on it and be in the moment with the sandwich.
Talking to Patrick Lochterman, he has a long-running blog featuring breakfast sandwiches, made at restaurants, made at home, whatever. He has some ideas to share with us, some favorites, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. I just got to say runny eggs for Eggs Benedict, not so much on the sandwiches.
Okay.
But there's a fantastic place, if you get a chance. It's off of Main Street in Menominee Falls. It's on the south side of the road. It's a little mom-and-pop gas station right across from the rebuilt Radisson Hotel that's there. They have the most amazing breakfast sandwiches. I don't know what they do to them, but they're fantastic. They have steak. They have bacon. You have sausage patty on English muffins or on croissants, and they're just out of this world.
They're always on croissants, Marcus?
I'm sorry?
Did you say they're always on croissants?
No, croissants, English muffins.
Okay.
I think they even have some on some sort of bun, like a bagel or whatever, but they are just out of this world.
Fantastic, Marcus. Thanks for that. Well, I wouldn't, Patrick, necessarily think to go to a gas station to find great breakfast sandwiches. Have you found some off the beaten path?
You know, I don't know if I've had any surprises at gas stations. I mean, most of the gas station ones I've had are more of a chain gas station. They're not a mom and pop place. But even those are, some of those are pretty good. I mean, I have some good ones from Quick Trip. You know, they have a lot of variety and generally they're pretty cheap. But I'd love to try that one in Menominee Falls, and that's exactly what I was hoping people would call in with ideas for places to stop whenever I happen to get in their neck of the woods.
Now let's talk about the bread. What are some of your favorite bread formats? We heard croissants and English muffins there. Those aren't the only options, though.
No, but English muffin is probably my favorite. I like that. I like that shape, and then you can make a nice little round puck egg that fits on it real well. It's about the right size. Croissants can be good if the croissant itself is really good. Then I'm on board with that. Some of them are just kind of squishy and sweet and kind of cruddy. They're not the flaky, light, nice croissant that you want. But at home I use a lot of wheat bread, to be honest. I mean, that's not the most exciting, but that's what I have around the house quite often.
Well, I want to get into some overlap, a little fusion here. You got breakfast sandwiches, but also people like pancakes, and sometimes the flavors can combine really well. I want to give a listen to a famous example that actually you also mentioned on your blog. Here's a listen.
Short stack of griddle cakes, melted butter, maple syrup, lightly heated, slice of ham. Nothing beats the taste sensation when maple syrup collides with ham.
So, have you had a breakfast sandwich, Patrick, where maple syrup collides with ham to good effect?
Yes, I think the one at there's one at Johnson Public House, I believe, has a syrup on it, and that is a fantastic sandwich. There's not as many ham ones out there as you might think. I know Porter in Madison also has a ham one, and I do like that. I'm glad you played that clip from Agent Cooper. He's
Twin Peaks. I should have identified that. Yeah.
Yeah.
He is a big breakfast fan, and definitely that's the second time I got to play it this week. This week's the 30th anniversary of a Twin Peaks debut. Well, we're in Wisconsin.
Right.
A lot of us, Patrick, are going to want some cheese on our breakfast sandwich. What are some of your favorite cheeses that play well with the eggs or the bacon or whatever?
Well, you know, excuse me, those American cheese slices are really perfect. They melt really well, and they've got that salty flavor. So that's always good. I do like a Gouda. I like to mix it up with a lot of different cheeses, but Gouda is maybe one of my favorites. Sharp cheddar, I like the flavor. It doesn't melt as well. So, you know, I'm usually looking for something a little softer that will melt and get all gooey.
Now, have you seen gourmet efforts? This seems like such a humble thing, right? The breakfast sandwich and kind of a messy thing. How fancy do people get with these guys?
They do, but some of them are really good. Croque Madame is a kind of a standard breakfast offering in some places. It's not really a sandwich because it's open faced, but that's ham and egg and usually Gruyere cheese, I think, and those are really good. So I mean, some of them get fancy. They add a lot of greens, and I don't like to overdo it with the greens, but
right.
But they can have a nice little crunch, and it makes you feel like you're eating something healthier, which you're probably really not, but you know, at least you can fool yourself into thinking it.
We're talking to Patrick Lochterman. He's a Wisconsinite who created the blog 52 Sandwiches 5 years ago. The original plan, eating one breakfast sandwich a week and writing about it. You can see sandwiches documented in photos on his Instagram, Bun Breakfast. And now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of the breakfast sandwich just for breakfast or any time of day? What are your favorite condiments, combinations, the breads to use, meat, no meat, favorite cheese, a surprise ingredient out of left field? Do you have a restaurant breakfast sandwich around the state or beyond that Patrick might want to try when we can get back into restaurants or gas stations or diners or whatever? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up this Food Friday conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Patrick Lochterman. He's a Wisconsinite who created the blog 52 Sandwiches. His original plan, eating and writing about one breakfast sandwich every week. You can see pictures on his Instagram, Bun Breakfast. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite breakfast sandwich? Do you turn to them weekly, daily? Are they a regular part of your fare? What's your favorite stuff to eat on them? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to your calls now. Phil is with us in Madison. Phil, hi.
Hi, yeah. My favorite tip for homemade breakfast sandwiches is I take some cream cheese, sprinkle some Cajun seasoning on top of it, pop it in the microwave for about, 10, 15 seconds, and you have the most amazing spread for any breakfast sandwich.
Ooh, and what kind of things do you combine that with then, Phil?
I mean, you would eggs, bacon, sausage, cheese, on a bagel, anything. But the sauce makes it just, the cream cheese melts and it turns into this really flavorful sauce. You probably put any sort of seasoning in it, but just the cream cheese is a vehicle to do sort of a, instead of a mayonnaise or something like that, it just makes this amazing creaming sauce that you put on a sandwich.
Melted cream cheese Cajun sauce, Patrick. I love it. What do you think?
I'm on board with that. I haven't tried that, but I will.
Yeah, thanks, is cream Bill. Cheese a common ingredient that you encounter on breakfast sandwiches?
It's not, and maybe it should be, I mean, it sounds like you can overdo it really easily, but it sounds like the way Phil's doing it, just a light little and add a little seasoning. I like that angle, and I'm going to try that. I don't know if I've made any at home with cream cheese. I don't think I have.
It seems obvious in a way because you put cream cheese on bagels, but I don't, for whatever reason, think of putting it on a breakfast sandwich either. And that makes me think, Patrick, you've tried a lot of different kinds of breakfast sandwiches at restaurants, at home, but you're still finding new surprises, it sounds like.
And I'm all for it, Bring it on.
Let's go back to our callers, see what they have for us. Carrie joins us now in Eau Claire. Carrie, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. Hey, I love a good breakfast sandwich, and I have to tell you, we've done a lot of work on them over the years, and my favorite is to take a really nice quality English muffin, something with a lot of nooks and crannies, and you put a fair amount of butter on it, because we love butter, and then a nice pepper jelly, and then a delicious breakfast sausage patty, piece of American cheese, and an egg, and it takes a while. It's labor intensive to make one for everyone because you have to do them individually, but I'm telling you what, ooh la la, they're fabulous.
And how spicy, Carrie, is your pepper jelly when you do this?
Well, it depends on who's making it. We love to make our own, but often we buy it from smaller orchards in the area and things like that. And it's fairly spicy, but you can adjust that if you prefer. But we like a jalapeno pepper jelly, and we just find that with the breakfast sausage, there's something about the sweet, the salty, and the spice that makes it fabulous.
Wow.
And plus the butter.
Carrie, that sounds fantastic. Patrick, what do you think?
Heck yeah, that sounds fantastic. I do like if I'm given a choice of options at a restaurant and there's something that's going to be spicy, I'm generally going to take that sandwich. So. Pepper jelly, and I know I've had one with pepper jelly, I think, at Ancora Coffee here in Madison, but I'm not 100% sure. But I have not made one with pepper jelly, but I might just try that, Carrie.
And she said, thank you, Carrie, for that call. She said the key thing about the English muffin, it's the nooks and crannies that make it special. It really absorbs the butter, and I guess in this case, the pepper jelly and the egg juice and whatnot.
Yep, and you get the cheese down in there. Whatever you got on there is going to sneak in there. It's perfect.
All right, back to your breakfast sandwich calls now. Thomas is on the line in La Crosse. Thomas, hi.
Hey, you guys were talking about gas station breakfast sandwiches, and if you ever get over by Reedstown, they've got an English muffin. It's actually a BP, but it's an English muffin with a big slab of ham and egg and cheese, and it is outstanding.
Oh, and how's the ham? Thin, thick cut? You said a big slab?
Oh, it's just a big, thick cut of ham.
Fantastic, Thomas. That sounds great. Another gas station for you to visit there, Patrick. What do you think? When you use ham, thick cut or thin cut, it's kind of a different sandwich, even though it's the same stuff.
Yeah, I like the thick cut. Thin cut just reminds me of like a deli sandwich. It just doesn't feel like a breakfast sandwich to me. So as long as it's good ham, that's really all that matters. But I do go thick cut. I prefer that.
Thomas, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. It is Food Friday. We're talking to Patrick Lochterman. You can read about breakfast sandwiches, lots of them on his blog, 52 sandwiches. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your favorite way to make or eat breakfast sandwiches or your recommendations for Patrick to get out and try them when restaurants and whatnot open up again. Let's go back to your calls now. Karen is with us in Woodstock, Illinois. Karen, hello.
Hey, how y'all doing today?
Good. What do you have for us, Karen? I'm getting hungry here.
Well, this will maybe hopefully make you a little hungry. I need to give it a try, but it was purely accidental. I oven roasted some tomatoes a few years ago till they get that really dark richness with just a little olive oil and salt and pepper. And so it wasn't really a breakfast sandwich, but, you know, a lot of people like savory in the morning. I put it on top of roast beef between some grilled slices, between some toast. And let me tell you, those slow roasted tomatoes added such richness to the beef that I was thinking it'd make a great egg sandwich as well as a condiment. So I'm suggesting if you haven't already, because I didn't hear the whole program, but oven slow roasted tomatoes are amazing.
That has not come up yet, Karen. Have you encountered anything like this in your travels, Patrick?
I have not, but I like the sound of that. Were those tomatoes you grew yourself, Karen?
No, I wish I could say so, but they were plum tomatoes, and they were so delicious. I was thinking there's got to be a way to market this because as a condiment, because I've never had anything so delicious. It just was one of those things that hit the spot. And anyway, so I wanted to share that. Slow-roasted tomatoes as a condiment.
Fantastic, yeah, Karen.
That sounds like it would blend with an egg perfectly. I think you're on the right track there.
Totally. Thanks a lot for the call, Karen. Let's just keep going with our callers. Chris now in Adams is with us. Chris, hi.
Hi. I have one that's a little bit off the beaten path, but this is one of my very favorite things. On a bagel, lox and cream cheese, an egg, however you want the egg done. And then hollandaise sauce and fresh asparagus on top with dill. It is absolutely delicious.
Wow. Sounds kind of rich, but sounds really good, Chris. Is this something you make all the time, or is this like a special occasion breakfast sandwich?
No. Well, you know, it's kind of ambitious. I make hollandaise sauce on a regular basis. So
wow.
In fact, I made it last night. Yeah, it's kind of rich. I don't take the calories out.
good. Don't think about that, Chris. Thanks a lot. Patrick, hollandaise sauce, I mean, that's the sauce on Eggs Benedict, right? So that seems like a natural for a sandwich.
Yeah, it can be a little rich for me. That sounds like a really messy sandwich she makes, but also really delicious. But, you know, once you're committed to the sandwich, why not get messy, you know? But, yeah, hollandaise sauce is a little rich for me generally if there's too much of it. And so Now every time I go out, I tend to order a breakfast sandwich, so I don't order Eggs Benedict or anything else. So I don't get to try other things. But there are some breakfast sandwiches out there that have hollandaise sauce on them.
Fantastic, thanks, Chris. We'll go now to John on the line in Toma. John, hello.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, where do you want to point us to, John?
Sparta, Wisconsin, off the interstate, off of 90. The first exit, I guess, when you're going west, I think that's 97 or something like that. 16, Highway 16, where it crosses the interstate and goes into Sparta. There's a BP there. They have a great breakfast sandwich there. You can get it on a different bun. You can get it on a bagel. You can get it on a English muffin. You can get it on a buttermilk biscuit. And they're all really nice size. Very good portion, and you can get them, like what the other caller said, with ham or any combination, but they got a really good pork sausage one there, too, so that's the one I like, but yeah, when I'm cruising by, so I just wanted to say about that one. So yeah.
Sounds great. John, Patrick, you're going to have to do, at some point in the future, a gas station tour of Wisconsin.
You know, I'm not against it. I mean, if you're driving around, you're going to need gas, so, but yeah, that's the second time somebody mentioned BP, and I'm not familiar with them having breakfast sandwiches, so I maybe I just need to get out more.
Thanks a lot for the recommendation. Rob joins us now calling from Ridgeway. Rob, hello.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What's your sandwich, Rob?
Well, I've got a bunch of them. I like to eat. what I do, like with my toast, is if I've cooked bacon, I will toast the bread in the bacon. And that really adds a good flavor to it. Hello?
Yep, you're still there. And what do you do for egg and other accoutrements in that sandwich, Rob?
Oh, what I'll do is when I'm frying the egg, I'll crack open the top and put onions or peppers on it, or onions or black pepper, possibly cheese, tomatoes, whatever. And then when I flip it over, all that stuff gets stuck into the egg. So that way it's a little bit neater sandwich.
That is fantastic. Wow, Rob, thanks a lot. So, Patrick, some creative use of the egg embedding the veggie portion in it.
Right, yeah. I mean, I've made some with like a soft scramble where you're just kind of throwing everything into the egg while it cooks and, you know, like throwing a handful of spinach or something, again, to fool yourself into thinking you're eating something healthy. But it does work. It kind of holds everything together.
All right, Desert Island, Patrick, at our last minute. Only one egg sandwich for a while. What would it be? What's one you could come back to again and again?
It'd probably be an English muffin. I mean, I might just keep it real simple and just go English muffin, bacon, over medium egg, maybe a Gouda cheese, and maybe a little avocado on there. That's been one of my favorite add-ons lately.
I could eat that every day. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Hey, thanks, Rob.
That's Patrick Lochterman. He created the blog 52 Sandwiches 5 years ago. You can see and read about the sandwiches on his blog at 52sandwiches.blogspot.com or on Instagram at Bun Breakfast. No space there. And you can keep sharing your favorite breakfast sandwich, maybe with a picture if you've got one, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the removal of Inspector General Glenn Fine and what it says about the $2 trillion economic recovery package passed by Congress and how it's going to be overseen in the days and months to come. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, climate change is a big concern for many people and governments across the globe. We'll talk to an author who argues that our current methods of tackling climate change don't go far enough and that we'll need to have bigger and bolder methods to stop it. We'll talk about geoengineering and how it could be used to fight climate change. First, as millions of people and businesses await money from Congress's $2 trillion stimulus package, the official who was charged with providing oversight for the program was removed from the post. Inspector General Glenn Fine was demoted this week and thus lost the top spot on the oversight committee. So far, there hasn't been any indication as to why Fine was ousted. Fine's removal follows the firing of another high-profile inspector general within the week. Our next guest joins us to talk about President Trump's relationship with the inspector general's office and what these firings say about how his administration works. Ellen Nakashima is a national security reporter for The Washington Post. Ellen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into some of these particular replacements and critiques of inspectors general, can you talk a little bit about why we have these inspectors general in federal government in the first place?
Well, there have actually been inspectors general since the country's founding, but it was after Watergate that Congress established the position in law as part of the series of reforms in response to the executive branch abuses in Watergate. The idea was that independent watchdogs would investigate wrongdoings in their respective agencies and report to the agency head as well as to Congress. And that was an important point there that Congress established in the law, that these watchdogs would also report back to Congress. It was important for accountability.
Is this a position that requires confirmation by the Senate?
Some of them do, and some of them don't. So there have been a series of reforms over the years, and I think there has been a push to make them Senate confirmed, but not all of them are.
Now, let's take it to this $2 trillion economic recovery package. They were doing a little something special for oversight here. What did Congress require when they passed this law when it came to who provided this kind of oversight?
Right. So on March 27th, Congress passed this $2 trillion coronavirus stimulus package known as the CARES Act. And as part of it, Congress wanted, stipulated that there be sort of a watchdog group, the PROC, Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, to ensure that this vast amount of money be spent wisely and in the best in the interests of taxpayers, with transparency and accountability. And the head of this committee was chosen by the head of a Council of Inspectors General, David Horowitz. He chose to head this committee Glenn Fine, who is a longtime, a very experienced inspector general who had been the inspector general at the Justice Department for 11 years, since 2000 to 2011, and through Democratic and Republican administrations. And Glenn Fine is actually at the Pentagon and had been the acting inspector general for 4 years, so longer than any other previous Pentagon inspector general. And by the way, longer, he had served at the DOJ as inspector general longer than any other DOJ IG. So he has a lot of experience. He was respected, seen as independent.
So he's selected to head this. He's selected to head this oversight committee. And then, what does the Trump administration do to make him, in effect, ineligible to do that?
What happened was on Monday, Glenn Fine was informed that he was no longer the acting inspector general. He would revert to his current position, which is the deputy inspector general, the number two person in that office. And because he was no longer holding the position of inspector general or acting inspector general, he was no longer eligible to serve as the chairman of this Pandemic Response Accountability Committee.
So now what? Who do we know who's going to take that spot and be in charge of overseeing, as you say, this vast amount of money, $2 trillion?
Right. We do not yet know. Horowitz must now select a new chairman, which he can from among, I think, seven or eight other inspectors general in the U.S. government. This is stipulated by the law. He has not yet announced who his pick is.
Have we heard from the Trump administration about why they replaced Fine in that role and why they did it now?
Not really. The most President Trump would say was an indication in one of his recent daily press conferences on coronavirus that he was kind of cleaning house of what he called Obama-era holdovers of officials who had served in the Obama administration. But of course, Glenn Fine had also served in the Clinton and Bush administrations as well. So it's just possible that it's the fact that he had been around for successive administrations, and it's that Trump felt maybe he couldn't be trusted, he wasn't going to be loyal. That's a big sticking point with President Trump, loyalty.
Talking to Ellen Nakashima, national security reporter at the Washington Post, about inspectors general. One replaced, effectively knocked out as head of an oversight committee for the $2 trillion economic recovery bill passed by Congress. But Ellen, not the only inspector general in the news now. Inspector General Michael Atkinson played a huge role in the whistleblower complaint related to Ukraine that ended up in Congress. What do we know about his firing now?
Right. Well, just a few days before Glenn Fine was ousted, Michael Atkinson was also given the axe. He was informed on Friday evening, a week ago, really, that he was going to be removed. Trump sent a letter to Congress saying that I'm going to be firing Inspector General Michael Atkinson in 30 days. And that's because there's a requirement in the law that he give Congress 30 days notice of his intent to fire. At the same time, Atkinson, who is the Inspector General, was the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, was put immediately on administrative leave. So he was effectively removed immediately, sidelined immediately. He's important because he's the Inspector General who received the whistleblower complaint from someone inside the intelligence community about a phone call President Trump had had last July with the president of Ukraine. And the call was so concerning to this official that the official decided they needed to raise it to the Inspector General. It eventually made its way to Congress and became really the center of the impeachment hearings and investigation that led to President Trump's impeachment and then his eventual acquittal by the Senate in February.
Has there been pushback from Congress when it comes to Atkinson's dismissal?
Yes, there's been quite a bit of pushback and outrage really over both Atkinson and Fine, because what this is and what lawmakers are responding to is the president's assault on independent oversight that, as we mentioned, has been set up since the days of Watergate, since post-Watergate. And Senator Chuck Grassley, for instance, he's a Republican and long been a champion of whistleblowers, sent a letter saying that he really wanted to see explanation for Atkinson's firing, and also wanted to know that there just need to be more protections in the law for these inspectors general, that when they are fired, they must be fired for just cause. Right now, the president can essentially fire them at will as long as he gives Congress 30 days notice in writing of his reasons. Now, the reasons could be, just as President Trump said in the case of Atkinson, he no longer has my confidence. Well, that's not seen as just cause in the eyes of most. Just cause would be something more like criminal misconduct, felony, or gross abuse of authority.
It seems like a fundamental tension here. As you mentioned earlier, Ellen, President Trump prizes loyalty among those in the executive branch. I don't think that's a controversial statement at all. But this is a position that seems like it was created specifically to not owe loyalty to a particular president, but rather to oversee a president. It seems like that's those two philosophies are going to clash no matter what. Is that right?
Well, absolutely. To do their job right, the inspector generals need to have a degree of independence and to not fear that retaliation or that they will lose their job if they raise concerns or conduct investigations that might in any way be seen as contrary to an official or their higher up's political interests or line. But that does seem to clash with the number one priority of the president here, which he prizes above all else, is personal loyalty. And we've seen that time and time again, and he hasn't made it a secret.
Ellen, we'll leave it there and watch as this develops. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Ellen Nakashima is a national security reporter for The Washington Post. She joined us today to talk about President Trump's dismissal of two inspectors general from key positions this week. Coming up, with climate change happening at a fast pace, a guest makes the case for geoengineering to help solve it. We'll meet the author of the new book, Hacking Planet Earth, that's coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. State health officials say it'll be 3 to 6 weeks before COVID-19 peaks in Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll talk with Department of Health Services Secretary Andrea Palm about what the state is doing to fight the virus, how much longer safer-at-home orders may be in place, and more. Now, climate change is a big concern for people around the world. According to a November Pew Research survey, a majority of Americans say the government isn't doing enough to address climate change or safeguard the environment. There are some standard plans to address climate change, such as cutting carbon emissions and regulating polluters, but those plans can take time, and some activists say we're moving too slowly to have a significant impact. But there are people around the world who are looking at novel methods to take on climate change. One potential solution being investigated is geoengineering. Our next guest says geoengineering could help not only slow climate change, but it could even reverse the crisis. Thomas Costigan is a journalist and author. His latest book is called Hacking Planet Earth, How Geoengineering Can Help Us Reimagine the Future. Thomas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, geoengineering, as I learned in your book, covers a lot of ground. Can you give us a basic definition that we can work with here?
Sure. It's really defined as the deliberate manipulation of the environment to thwart or mitigate or even counteract the effects of global warming. So definitely intervening in Mother Nature's natural process through artificial means.
And as I mentioned, a lot of people think, hey, wait, we already have a solution. It's cut emissions, cut climate pollution. That's going to fix the problem. You write that's not happening fast enough. Why not?
Because it hasn't. You know, we've been having this discussion, and I've been in this space for, 20 years, and we've been having the same mitigation discussion. By mitigation, I mean preventative measures, much along the lines of what you're talking about, which is turn down the thermostat, stop our cars from idling, turn off the lights when we leave a room. Don't get me wrong, all great measures, but they haven't worked fast enough. We're still seeing an increase in global carbon emissions, and we need fixes. Much like the public health crisis, when we are told to wash our hands and do social distancing, great preventative measures, but now we need cures, we need treatments. And the planet is at a state now where it needs cures, it needs treatments, it needs its own sort of vaccines. And I believe a lot of the technologies that geoengineering provides can accommodate that.
As I said, geoengineering covers a lot of ground. On some of the most basic levels, things like carbon capture methods, which can be as simple as planting more trees, can be part of the solution. Where do you see carbon capture fitting in?
Yeah, well, just to come back to your original question, geoengineering can be solar engineering, which is better reflecting the sun, or carbon engineering, which is what you just discussed now, and there's a couple of other forms we can get into. But carbon engineering, that planting more trees is great, but that, again, takes, a long time for those trees to mature, for those trees in order to capture carbon and sequester enough of carbon in the atmosphere to make a difference. You would need, by some estimates, to plant a forest the size of India to make a big difference at mass scale for the planet to reduce any carbon emissions. When you have things like artificial trees and carbon capturing devices that can exponentially capture carbon out of the atmosphere, now we have a different game changer. And there are some technologies out there that can have, one device capture as much carbon as a tree at 1,000 times the rate. So you have a lot of technologies out there that I believe can step in there and help Mother Nature do her job.
You also mentioned solar engineering. What does that look like?
Yes, and this one may be the most controversial because that involves a few different types of all these technologies, of course. Solar engineering involves a few different steps. The most radical, far out there, let's put it out there on the spectrum, is a space parasol for the planet, where they would launch – scientists would launch nano-reflective materials into outer space to reflect the sun and thereby divert its energy before it even reaches Earth. The next one is stratospheric aerosol injection, which gets into some of the more controversial things here, whereas it's injecting different types of materials that they're testing up in the stratosphere. It's about 12 miles up. And that would, again, reflect from the tops of clouds the sun's energy and thereby cooling things below, like us, and surface temperatures. And then there's marine cloud brightening, which uses sea spray. So having ships that would traverse the oceans, some, you know, contemplated on autopilot, that would spray ocean water up into the atmosphere. Marine clouds sit a little bit lower in the sky than traditional clouds, and they would capture that spray. Those are reflective materials, and that again would cool the oceans below. And then there's one other form that I like to talk is about more of an analog version of all that, and that is cool roofs and cool roads, simply lightening the dark surfaces on what we call urban heat islands, alleys, blacktops, roads, those types of things, just making them lighter or using different types of materials, again, to reflect the sun's rays from capturing in all that heat.
Talking to Thomas Costigan about his new book, Hacking Planet Earth, How Geoengineering Can Help Us Reimagine the Future. Thomas, a concern people might have with some of these ideas, especially I think with some of the solar engineering ones, is weather and climate are complicated systems. Isn't there a risk of unintended side effects that could create maybe new and different problems than climate change?
Absolutely. Great question. You know, I had originally titled the book Frankenplanet. To address exactly those types of questions, because, you know, when you look at things like, you know, genetically modifying things, you know, things that step into the unknown of consequences, you do have a lot of those concerns. But I really want to emphasize that the book gets into things that are backed by rigorous science, and no one's out there recklessly doing so. And if they are, they shouldn't be. And even in the book, I mentioned some of those techniques and I put caveats in there that, you know, we really need to have an oversight type of committee that looks at these. But some of the consequences could affect teleconnections. You know, when you look at an El Nino, a La Nina event, those create pass along events, as many of us know, throughout the world. So when you have warmer ocean water, for example, off the coast of South America, which is where, you know, El Nino came from, the term, that has a pass-along consequence all the way up through North America, over to Europe and all around the globe, that, you know, could create dry circumstances in some places or wet circumstances in other places. And the same thing might hold by artificially interfering with the climate that way. And there are circumstances where they've tested that out in computer model version. And again, if we just look at the technologies that we have today, all of this, or pretty much all of this, is happening in laboratories and in the virtual world, where we can use artificial intelligence and algorithms to play out in seconds many, many variants of these types of technologies being put into practice and what those ramifications might be. And with the technologies and the computer simulations that are available today, you have a really interesting possibility to model these technologies out to see what those consequences could be. And most recently, there was an academic paper out late last month, about stratospheric aerosol injection, that if you did it at mass scale to really, really affect the planet, there would be consequences. It could result in everything from the Amazon catching fire to, you know, mass floods in other places. But if you did it at an incremental level, the risk would be far, far mitigated on any of these things having such a destructive force to them, but would still have an effect on climate change. So if you look at them singularly, yeah, it's difficult to be able to change the climate with just one of these technologies. But, you know, having a bunch of Plan B weapons at our disposal as climate starts to roll in with some of its more dire consequences, I think is just prudent.
Thomas, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Thomas Costigan, a journalist and author. We've been talking about his latest book. It's called Hacking Planet Earth, How Geoengineering Can Help Us Reimagine the Future. He joins us to talk about these ideas of geoengineering, from things that capture carbon in various different ways to things that might block the amount or reflect out the amount of energy coming in via sunlight to the Earth as a part of an effort to address and potentially reverse climate change. Love to hear from you about this topic. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. What do you think? Sound like science fiction for better or worse? Do you think these are ideas that governments, businesses, entrepreneurs, inventors should be pursuing? What kind of oversight would we need if we were to tackle one of these paths? Again, email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Yesterday on the show, I invited you to share some things that make you laugh, in part because we have an interview about the benefits of laughter yoga coming up next week. Here are a few of your responses. Diane writes, I go to funny commercials. Favorites are Cherry Coke and Vanilla Coke meeting, the Orkin man who moves in, and Geico Woodchucks at the Lumberyard. Diane says, I laugh just thinking about them. You know, I do find some of the funniest laugh out loud things, sometimes in weird places, not where I expect. So, Diane, I could see that. A caller called in to say that he goes to anything Red Skelton, the comedian Red Skelton on YouTube, particularly the character Clem Cadiddlehopper. That's fun just to say, actually. And Kristen sent us one with a visual. I'll tell you about that. She writes, it's always struck me kind of interesting the role that culture and context plays in comedy. For example, Kristen says, I don't find anything at all humorous about COVID-19. However, when a friend from Minnesota shared the attached graphic with me, I found myself laughing harder than I have probably in weeks. I look away, take a breath, look at it again, and laugh just as hard the second time. Well, here's the image. It showed the Minnesota Vikings logo on one side and far apart, Lombardi Trophy on the other. Non-football fans, that's what you get when you win the Super Bowl. The caption reads, social distancing since 1967. All right, well, sports and humor all rolled up into one. Thanks for your suggestions of great laughter material. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.